Hello, and welcome to the Decade in Review on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Retall. In this episode, we'll be discussing the highlights of the past decade. As with our weekly comic spotlight shows, we'll be using DC, Marvel, and other as our main categories.
Okay, welcome to the first ever Decade in Review for the Comic Book Page podcast. We're going to be talking about comics that were released in the aughts, or anything with a 2000, either 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, or 9. Since I don't think we've actually gotten anything for 2010 yet, I don't think I'll accidentally slip any of those in. So, we're going to review kind of the big picture for the whole decade. We're going to try to break things into DC, Marvel, and other. Obviously, there'll be some overlap in a few areas where either titles jump ship or we just remember something later in the episode. And really, I think this was a good decade for comics. I think the 90s kind of get a bad rap in a few places. That's when a lot of people left comics. I think the 80s was a good decade, but I think the first decade of this millennium or whatever, we just had some great stuff come out.
Yeah, I'm really crossing my fingers that we don't have this skip thing, because the 80s was really good, and then the 90s was bad.
But the 70s were good, too.
The 70s were good, too, yeah, and the 60s were good, too. So let's hope that the 90s were just an anomaly, and that the teens or the 2010s, whatever, is going to really continue being a great decade for comics also.
Yeah.
If they're still around in 2020.
Yeah, I think 2030 may be the off year, because you look at the 50s, the 90s, so it's a 40-year cycle, we'll say.
There you go.
But we'll find out in a few decades on that. But yeah, the last 10 years, great stuff. Over at DC, I think it's been kind of a, I don't say a defining era, but certainly a period of transition, because we saw Dan Didio come in with his kind of grand plan that we've seen come to fruition and beyond, really. And we're starting to see, as of the end of 2009, this transition towards DC entertainment, more integration with the television, the movies, and the mass media. But, you know, focusing just on the comics right now for DC, you know, in the mainstream universe, I've got to say the defining thing is Geoff Johns. You look at what he's done on Green Lantern, Superman, Flash, JSA, and anything else he has touched. It's just gold.
Yeah, and we highlighted him as our favorite writer of 2009, but it extends back, beyond that. I think, and maybe it's just, you know, you're not remembering some of the stuff from the very beginning of the decade. I mean, there were certainly other writers who were key in the decade, but, you know, closing it out on a strong note, certainly, Geoff Johns. I also think that, you know, just the whole rebirth of Hal Jordan and the revitalization of the Green Lantern franchise in a positive, upbeat fashion, because I like Kyle Rayner, but what I didn't like, and I think sat poorly with a lot of people about the transition from Hal to Kyle, was the general style where they felt to establish Kyle, they had to tear down and destroy the Hal Jordan character. Whereas Geoff Johns came up with an extremely elegant way to bring Hal back while not degrading Kyle Rayner. And also just kind of fit everything in a really elegant way that just made sense and added such a richness to the Green Lantern mythos with the whole, you know, what is parallax and, you know, all this other kinds of stuff that just tied everything together.
Yeah, and I mean, if you think about it, 10 years ago, can you imagine sitting down with your friends talking about comics and saying, gosh, I wish they would do a major event storyline centered around Green Lantern? It'd be like, yeah, that might be cool, but it'd be a hard sell. Now it's like, obviously, we're seeing that. And the bringing back of Hal Jordan, you're right, they did it a great way. And it was something that could have been very divisive. But just the expansion of the mythos of the Green Lantern property over the last 10 years, and a lot of it in the last two or three, really, has, I think, expanded the concept, the premise, and the viability of it. I mean, we've now gotten a direct-to-DVD animated feature. They're talking about doing a movie for the Green Lantern stuff. They've been talking about that for a while. But, you know, it's a highlight of the decade, and one in which DC, overall, I think, had a very, very strong couple of years there, you know, where they just were knocking stuff out of the park. You know, if you look at the event comics and the weekly comics, I mean, the event stuff, it may have been hit or miss for some people, whatever, but Infinite Crisis got a lot of attention, Final Crisis got a lot of attention, and where editorially, both in terms of just the content and, but also on the production side, DC knocked it out of the park with the weekly comics. They did. Yeah. Three weekly comics, I believe, in a row, because I don't think there was a gap between Countdown and Trinity, but there might have been a few weeks. But 3-year-long, 52-issue weekly series without a single issue late, and then the 12-issue Wednesday comics. And that's got to be a hellacious process for the creative team and the editorial and production teams. And they did it without missing a beat.
Yeah, now, quality of the stories aside, other than 52, I wasn't.
I liked Trinity. I know you didn't. Countdown, I think we can agree that it was a. That was one, though, where I think we saw the. I don't want to say the end of DDO's grand vision or whatever, but that's where things started to unravel. Is the whole Countdown around the time of the 1 year later. But if you look at when DDO first came in, we had Young Justice, we had a Titans series. He retransitioned those into a Teen Titans series, an Outsider series, and you could see where he was planting the seeds with different creative teams to have things kind of follow a progression over time to where he was kind of slowly retooling and rebuilding the DC Universe. And then come Infinite Crisis, you know, they tried to do some major shifting of directions, creative teams, etc., with the 1 year later, which was very ambitious, and very successful in so much as getting people to try stuff out, not so much in terms of retaining people, but it's like the beginning of a new TV series. People are going to check out more shows than they're going to end up watching every week come the middle and the end of the season. So, you know, where creatively I think Geoff Johns was the most valuable player, I think editorially it was a very interesting decade for DC, but probably nowhere near as interesting as the 2010s are going to be. With Paul Levitz stepping down and presumably a new power structure coming into play over the next couple of years.
Yeah, interesting on the DC side because, you know, we do, while we flex this sometimes on our weekly episodes, the various imprints of DC and Marvel, we do count as DC and Marvel. It's just that some weeks when John and I don't actually have an indie book that we both bought, we might, you know, throw in a Vertigo or a Wildstorm or an Icon book or something like that as the other book. But in general, we count Vertigo, Wildstorm, and all these things as part of DC. And I think these imprints also had some very solid and defining series, and you know, in each decade for Vertigo anyway, they had some really nice stuff come out in the 90s, and some of the hallmarks for the 2000s for Vertigo, I feel, Why the Last Man, that saw its run come out and it concluded, Fables, which is still ongoing, which is an excellent and perennial seller, I think, in trade paperback for Vertigo, as well as 100 Bullets, which saw its entire 100-issue run come out. I think it started in 99, but the majority of it came out. It ran, you know, that 100 issues ran pretty much the whole decade. So, you know, that was certainly some hallmark stuff that came out from DC imprints of Vertigo. And then on Wildstorm, we had talked about Ex Machina, which again, you know, like Y, Brian K. Vaughan doing that, as well as Planetary. Which again, Planetary, I think the first issue came out in 99, but
I think it might have been 2000.
Maybe it might have crept in, but I thought I saw 99 as the official published date on it. But I mean, that series pretty much crept out over the entire decade as well. But that was another one that certainly is a really unique and complicated and compelling story that came out and was excellent and a highlight for me of the decade.
I would say with Wildstorm, they've had a rough time because the Wildstorm universe itself is kind of a rocky thing that I think they've retooled a few times. Where they tend to succeed is on these solo titles, be it Planetary or Ex Machina, and the miniseries. And the problem with the miniseries is, you know, you wait 5-10 years, and as great as it may have been, like Global Frequency or something like that, it's hard to be remembering at the end of a decade in review kind of a thing of, oh yeah, what brilliant things did they come out with? So I think Wildstorm gets a bad rap because of how rocky the main universe is and doesn't get enough credit for, again, things like Ex Machina and the solo titles they do that can just be so extraordinary.
And there were some little ones in there I thought that were really, really nice series that came out. I remember, you know, Highwaymen came out. We had Storming Paradise. You know, they just have lots of little series that come out under the Wildstorm imprint that are very well done.
Yeah. Now, with Vertigo, for me, Fables is hands down the defining series, I think, for the decade for them. They had great stuff overall. I mean, Vertigo always has a strong lineup. Hellblazer's been going on forever and a day and is probably going to continue doing so. But I really have to wonder if, for the 2010s, is it going to be Fables that's going to be kind of the lead book? Could it become something like Air or Unwritten? But this is an area where, on the Vertigo side, strong editorial leadership and just a good eye for picking good properties is what's been keeping them on the map and consistent quality. Now, with Wildstorm, the other imprint to kind of talk about there is a sub-imprint almost of Wildstorm, and that's America's Best Comics. That was one that came and went during the decade, essentially, and just had some brilliant stuff in it. The Tom Strong stuff, the Top Ten stuff was great.
Promethea.
That one never clicked for me, but it was well done.
But it was well done, and it's one that a lot of people are big fans of. I mean,
yeah,
it's
agreed.
It was well enough that they actually thought enough of it to put out an absolute of it.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure how well that absolute sold, but
they have not yet done
an absolute of Top Ten, for instance, which I would have bought an absolute of Top Ten.
Yeah, or Tom Strong. I mean, yeah, there are a couple others. The Tomorrow Stories I thought were really good. And anthologies can be a hard sell for me sometimes. That was one that I wish they could have kept going a bit longer and a bit stronger. Yeah. They're still trickling out some Top Ten stuff now and again, but for all intents and purposes, the glory days or whatever of America's Best Comics are kind of behind us in terms of the amount of output.
Right.
Any other kind of highlights you can think of at the moment for DC?
I think that's hitting it for me for DC, and I'm sure, you know, come and discuss on our forum, because I'm sure there are things that didn't occur to us that will occur to other people, and we'll say, don't, you know, we should have thought
of
that one.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, yeah. The series of mini Batman events, you know, over the years. Bottom line is, to me, these were the highlights, but DC had really strong stuff just on average across the board. So there's tons of stuff I'm sure we're just not mentioning that somebody can point out, and it's like, yeah, damn it, we really should have pointed that out. That was excellent. Now, over at Marvel, I would say there's really two groups of writers that are kind of the defining, three actually, I'm going to say, are the defining forces at Marvel. Abnett and Lanning on the Marvel Cosmic. Brubaker and Company, if you will, on Captain America, Daredevil, and Iron Fist, kind of that serious corner of the Marvel Universe, and then the guys doing the Amazing Spider-Man stuff.
Well, then you also got to give, I think for the whole decade, you got to give Bendis the nod there, too.
Because, well, I kind of included him in the Brubaker and Friends, but you're right.
I think Bendis kind of stands by himself as almost like an architect of the 2000s, you know, with his whole, you know, backbone through the Avengers.
Yeah.
And, you know, that really kicked off a lot of it, you know, through the house of, you know, Avengers Disassembled, that whole Disassembled stuff. And he's kind of taken a little bit of a backseat in the last year or so, in my mind, to some of these other guys. But as a driving force for the whole decade, I think Bendis has got to get a lot of credit for a lot of the revitalization of Marvel has come out of Brian Michael Bendis.
I think you're entirely right, because you look at the event comics they did over the decade of House of M, Civil War, World War Hulk, Secret Invasion, the Dark Reign stuff. With all except for maybe World War Hulk, I mean, he was the guy.
Yeah.
So you add to that what he did over on the Avenger books and for a while on Daredevil and everywhere else he's been, and you're right, he's kind of the really, for the longest time, the backbone of the Marvel Universe over there creatively. And some of his stuff I liked more than others, but you got to give him credit for charting that course and really how successful it's been.
Yeah, he's really kept the vision, and when he's, you know, you a lot of people, and myself included, you talk about, you know, decompressed storytelling and all this kind of stuff, and he gets that rap and he gets that label attached to him, and I've done it myself in the past, but to be fair to him, he has you know, kind of defined a storytelling style and been very successful at setting a tone and direction for the Marvel Universe that has served them very well, has really kept them on top throughout the decade.
Well, and it shows that he's a team player, because I thought his transition off of Daredevil with Brubaker coming on after him was one of the smoothest transitions of a title I've seen in ages. And this is in the day and age where every story arc by a different creative team, it's like, okay, let's take characters, move them, give them a new headquarters, give them a new name, you know, and throw everything out with the bathwater kind of deal. So for that kind of a ego-less, smooth transition as he's going off the book, I was very pleased with.
Another piece of real strong credit I'd give Marvel is just in the 2000s, coming off the what I would consider to be a real directionless train wreck that was the 90s for Marvel.
Yeah.
Especially when they lost a tremendous amount of their top talent to, you know, the guys who created Image back in the, you know, early-ish to mid-90s. And they were somewhat directionless for a while and just kind of flailing around and put out a lot of, I don't think a lot of people, I mean, it got a lot of people into comics, but it was pretty weak stuff when you compare it to almost any other era of Marvel comics, and just turning that around. And another person who gets a tremendous amount of credit for that is Joe Quesada.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And you're right, because when a lot of people say, oh, I left comics in the 90s, if you push, I think a lot of those cases are going to be because of various Marvel things. And I don't want to place blame over at Marvel, but it was not a strong decade for them. And they spent the later part of that decade kind of rebuilding and retooling. But between the Marvel Knights stuff, some of the other things Quesada put in place, and what Bendis had done, they may have started out the 2000s in a little bit of a rebuilding stage. I think they'd gotten through most of it by then, though. But it was long since behind them creatively during this decade. Certainly by the end of it, they've reestablished top talent on books. They've created, they've elevated people from, you know, newcomers into top talent on books. You know, they've really come a long way on that, like you said, directionless era about 20 years ago.
Where, so, you know, almost like just the rebirth of Marvel Comics in the 2000s, because, you know, what they are today compared to what they were is a huge success story creatively.
Yeah, and Quesada and the editorial team deserve credit for that. And when you've got strong editors like Brevoort and stuff like that, you know, and when they grabbed Steve Wacker, who had done the initial part of 52, to take over the Spider-Man titles when it was going to go thrice monthly, that's just a smart move. You know, so they've made some good decisions. Now, part of that, I think, was also, you know, carving off different corners of the universe, if you will. Because you've got what Bendis had started with Daredevil, what Brubaker really took advantage of with Captain America, and then some of the Iron Fist stuff, where you've got this almost, I guess you would call it kind of the noirish stuff, but what I would just call a serious, realistic-ish take on superheroes with Daredevil, Cap, and some of the other kind of street-level type characters that has a sense of reality, a sense of, I almost want to say, Tom Clancy-ishness to it in a way that really works, yet keeping those characters in the Marvel Universe to where they can interact with the Avengers and other characters, whatever, but disconnected enough that every time a World War Hulk or something else comes traipsing through the universe, they don't get pounded on. And that was a tough call, I bet, creatively and editorially, for them to make that decision and stick to it, but one that I think has paid off in spades.
Yeah, and you know, that's to their credit. You know, like the Bendis and Brubaker runs on, you know, Daredevil and Cap and, you know, some of these other titles like that were pretty much unmolested by these crossovers in their main title. And that's always distracting when you have a really solid creative run going and then you drop, like, you know, Secret Wars into the middle of it.
Yeah.
It just does something. It's just like, keep those things off in their own corner. I mean, that's very disruptive in the X universe, for instance, when you're reading a title and then all of a sudden, if you're not reading everything in the universe, you're just not able to even enjoy it.
I mean, I think they could have done a decent crossover for Secret Invasion with Skrulls and Shapeshifters and stuff and Cap or Daredevil or Iron Fist, but I'm so glad they didn't. Because while they could have made it fit the tone of the book and make it work, I really prefer how, particularly Brubaker and Captain America, from that first issue up to where they are now with the whole return of Steve Rogers and all that stuff, the arc they've had, particularly for Bucky and stuff over that time, has just been smooth and graceful and amazing. So not having to interrupt that periodically for the event du jour is nice. Now, the other area I think Marvel really excelled at, because I think they gave a couple of writers their own little playground or whatever, was giving Abnett and Lanning the cosmic area to play with. Going back to Annihilation and the couple of miniseries that led up to that, the few miniseries that went from there to Annihilation Conquest, which eventually gave us the Nova and Guardians of the Galaxy ongoing titles, as well as War of Kings, Realm of Kings, etc. of the Kings, or whatever. They've taken a hard-to-use area of the Marvel Universe and made it viable. I mean, at best, there would be a Silver Surfer series back in the day, you know, for the cosmic stuff, maybe Guardians of the Galaxy or whatever, set in the future, but we've got two ongoing titles set in space and the cosmic stuff for Marvel.
As well as this ongoing set of minis.
Yeah, just to say, the series of miniseries, yeah.
Which actually is, they're doing it because of market conditions, but it's almost like it's a third series, and they just kind of break it up into the miniseries, you know, wisely, because I think if it was one ongoing series, it would have much worse numbers.
Yeah.
Just from the, you know, vagaries of how those kind of things work. So no, they've done a really nice job on that, too. So,
yeah, both in terms of keeping the quality up and just the, by shifting the title, it allows them to do marketing pushes, etc., and keep the interest up. It's just, it's working really well. So, and again, this is kind of new ground, pardon the pun, I guess, for Marvel, and isn't competing or oversaturating with any of the other titles they had kind of going before. In other words, they're not taking one Hulk title and spinning it out into eight, although they have over in the Hulk area.
They did that.
Or over the X-Men area. You know what I mean? This is one where they're adding to their roster of viable properties and not strip mining it. Now
that you mention it, though, you know, however we may personally feel about the expansion of the Hulk thing, I think it is notable that, you know, when you say over at DC, and I don't think it's at the same level or anything, but, you know, how many people 10 years ago would have believed you if you would have said, oh, yeah, there are going to be like about seven or eight different Hulk titles going on at one time? You know, they looked at you like you're crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
I look at it like it's crazy even today.
I think it is crazy, but I'm enjoying a lot of those titles. Less so with the Hulk itself, Incredible Hulk, Incredible Hercules, some of these others are good, but it worries me whenever they take one title and spin it out into four or five, because it seems like you're just cannibalizing your own audience. And both Marvel and DC are doing this, as are some of the independent publishers. You know, you could argue if Project Superpowers over at Dynamite would be stronger if they didn't have, you know, a parallel miniseries plus the Black Terror and this other stuff going on. You know, and it's interesting because at Marvel, they actually in one area went in the other direction, sort of. And that's with Amazing Spider-Man. I think they made a really smart move to go from Amazing Spider-Man and two secondary titles of Friendly Neighborhood and Spectacular, I think it was at the time, integrate those into the same number of issues a month, so thrice monthly, but under one title. And that has really smoothed out the sales across the three issues a month, whereas before it would be a 2-to-1 difference from Amazing and either of the other two.
They also did a huge about face, because I mean this was part of the decade too, but they had gotten really far afield, and I don't know how much of this was Straczynski and how much was editorial direction, but you know they had gotten the Spider-Man character really, really far away from the core, what I think a lot of people, myself included, loved about the Spider-Man character, with the whole, you know, Moreland and, you know, Back in Black and Sins of the Past. And it's just like all these event upon event in that title, instead of, I think, concentrating on just telling stories of the character that that showcased what people love about Spider-Man. You know, and while I didn't really like the whole Mephisto, you know, undoing the wedding, you know, kind of thing that got us to Brand New Day. Once we got to Brand New Day, they took that and ran with it, and they've been doing a really good job of just telling fun Spider-Man stories in that title, you know, since then. So I think turning that character around, because Spider-Man, I think you really got to say, he is the flagship character at Marvel. He's the most recognizable, universally superhero that Marvel's got.
Oh, I agree with that entirely. And you bring up a very interesting point about, I mean, first off, since they went thrice monthly and, you know, kind of revitalized and, I don't say rebooted, but retooled the Spider-Man stuff, it's been just top-notch. And again, I give credit to Wacker as editor for coordinating all of that and getting the right people in the room to be telling the stories. But you look at just prior to that with the One More Day, like you said, the Back in Black, the Other, and all the little kind of mini spider events they had leading up to all of that. And, well, I agree that got it character far afield from where it could have and should have been and from the core of Spider-Man. What it really hammers home to me is that I think the first decade of 2000 has been the decade of branding, because you look at how they were branding each of those story arcs, how they've, you know, we've been talking about kind of the Marvel Cosmic as its own little brand, or the Serious Universe of the Marvel with Cap, Daredevil, etc. as its own little brand, and how they've been using the banner of Dark Reign for the last year or so. And how they need to have this shingle to hang above some of these story arcs for marketing purposes, etc. And I'm just seeing that more and more, both at Marvel, DC, and really everywhere else, that if I had a takeaway from this decade, I really think that's got to be it. We've become a much... I think it's important because comics have always been a brand-aware media.
Interesting, you know, that you say that. It leads me to, you know, more so than that, or maybe an adjunct to that, is it's become the decade of the story arc and the decade of the trade paperback. We hadn't thought of that before.
Yeah, no, I think you're entirely right, because during this decade, the trade paperback list went from, I'm not even sure it existed at the start of the decade off the top of my head, I'd have to check, but if it did, it was 10 deep, now it's 300 deep every month for the top sellers from Diamond. So we have definitely gone away from the never-ending saga to the serialized into a 4 to 6 issue chunk to compartmentalize into a trade paperback or other collected edition. And I think that is a fundamental change in the nature of the stories and in the industry that kind of does go along with the branding but kind of is its own thing as well. And I think that's a very excellent point. And one
and
that
it's fundamentally changed how people tell stories.
Well, how they tell them, what stories they can tell. Because you can't tell big, sprawling stories in the same way you could tell them before, and it's harder to tell self-contained stories. I think part of why I'm loving Uncle Scrooge over at Boom so much these days is at the end of the issue, I've gotten a complete story or two. Whereas in a lot of comics, I feel like we're just getting the teaser of a story, or instead of an entire equivalent to a television episode, just the chunk between the commercial breaks. And the and that's partially the decompression, etc. But you're right, it's fundamentally changed the nature of comic book storytelling and the expectations of the readers and of the writers, and the artists to a lesser degree. You know, I think the writers no longer expect to have to introduce their characters every issue, to reassert the status quo or to reset the scene at the beginning of every issue. And I think that's detrimental to comics. Because while the shift has gone creatively, mindset-wise, editorially mindset-wise, towards this is going to get packaged as a trade paperback, because let's face it, 99% or so of everything published is getting collected. Now versus at the beginning of the decade, I think that percentage was a fraction of that, maybe 5%. I don't know. I'd have to go look that up. A noticeable amount, but not everything. But we're not seeing the income reflect that. The lion's share of the income for most publishers is still seeming to come from the monthly comics when you compare just the comics and the trades. Obviously, there's licensing toys, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But excluding those, just from the stories, the comics are still the lion's share of the income.
Different brands work differently there.
Oh,
I think,
certainly.
You know, the mainstream superhero stuff, for the most part, I think still is, you know, reads a little better like that. But I think, you know, when you look over at Vertigo at DC,
You're right, for instance,
I think that they have really built a nice model for themselves where you've got people who follow those series every 6 months or so on the trade paperback who never pick up an issue.
Well, Vertigo's a good example because I think if I were to chart just the Vertigo comics and trade sales, that would be one where we would probably see the 80% being on the trade side just because it's got such a strong presence there with the Fables, the Why the Last Man, the 100 Bullets, the Sandman stuff showing up on the list most months compared to the handful of new comics they've got that month. So you're right. It obviously it varies imprint to imprint, publisher to publisher. But that's, I think, a front runner in terms of that trend. And I think the rest of the industry is a long way behind and may, in some cases, never catch up.
Another,
you know, while I see a demand for the next for the current story arc in Fables getting collected and doing well in a collected edition, I can't say the same thing about your average arc on your average mid-list Marvel or DC book.
Yeah, and that's the thing, though. It's like you take, like, I don't know, like Booster Gold or Blue Beetle or something, and it's like any one particular story arc. I just don't think there's, like, the audience for reading a six-issue chunk of that. Now, whereas, you know, something that's a little more, you know, high profile, like you look at, especially like a mini series like Secret Invasion or something that ties into it, or even like the Spider-Man books that they put out in a row, or, you know, Superman, or, you know, main characters that people recognize. I think those are more saleable in trade paperback format than some of these kind of B-list characters. So it's not like everything in the superhero realm is not necessarily something that's going to lend itself to that as easily.
Certainly, certainly. You look at, again, something like Civil War when collected in trade, it will accumulate sales over time that give it higher sales than even some relatively top-selling, but not the top-selling book, you know, monthly issues over at Marvel. You know, it's totaled up to somewhere around 37,000 units for the Civil War trade paperback. And in November, I think there were only one or two titles that met or exceeded that comic-wise, comic issues for the month. Now, granted, it took that trade paperback a while to accumulate those sales. But we're at a point where, in this decade, trade paperbacks really came into their own, became not a should we do this, but a de facto it will be done. And I use trades to encompass other collected editions here. Because sometimes the hardcover comes first, sometimes the trade, then they'll do an absolute or an omnibus or whatever. But I think in the 2010s, we may see a shift in the business model over time to where those trades become an increasing amount of the revenue and may actually start justifying content creation on their own, and we might see some more original content type material in that respect. Because that's still reasonably rare, particularly from Marvel and DC, and really even from the independents. It's either reprints of individual issues, or it is trade paperback size reprint and translations of foreign material. And there's nothing wrong with all that, but it's not paying or not justifying creating new original content. And that's just, you know, a business aspect. But yeah, I think the branding, the trade paperback stuff, has really been a game changer over the last decade. The other thing at Marvel I think was new and relevant and stuff in the last 10 years is the creation of Icon. You know, where they did some creator-owned stuff, and this seems to be a by invitation only sort of an imprint, or a very selective one at the very least, with stuff by Brubaker, Bendis, David Mack.
David Mack, yeah.
Yeah, a very select group of people. And I think it's good for them to be dipping their toe in the waters here, but it seems to be, from my point of view, it's almost like it's a perk they can give some people when they signed exclusives, but not something that they're really looking to turn into a Vertigo kind of imprint.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think, you know, the key differentiator there is, you know, they're really, that same book I could see coming out from Image. Same exact book. And in fact, Powers did come out from Image. And the difference is that same exact book coming out from Image would sell tremendously less. Because, you know, the people who will buy Marvel and DC books are the stores that will stock Marvel and DC books are not going to buy the same number of copies if it's not a Marvel or DC book.
And that's where I go back to this being a very brand-aware media. Because people, it's like, it matters if it's from Marvel or Image or DC. Whereas I don't think there's that same perception for television shows of, well, I'll get it if it's on ABC, but if it's on something else, I won't watch it. Or does it matter what studio a movie comes out or what publisher prints a book? That's one of the things I find very unique about the comic arena. So, I agree, though, content-wise, most of what's from Icon can or did come out from, you know, like an image-type thing with zero difference in content.
Right. Now, moving into image, I mean, not image, really, but, you know, the other or indie kind of thing, I think image is another key thing that's coming in here, because you had image in the 90s, to me, was almost epitomized, and they were created in the 90s, they were very successful, but they were, to me, characterized by almost vacuous splash page, you know, action driven stories that didn't have a lot of meat to them and were more flash and very little substance. And in the 2000s, Image, I think, has changed in that it is putting out some really, really interesting work by a whole variety of different creators, that just the most variety of really interesting, cool stuff of pretty much any company that if I had to pick one company out there that has just such a diverse portfolio of things, Image would get that nod. And I see that as almost a complete retooling of the direction for the company.
I agree and I disagree. I think it's a retooling of how people view Image. Because I think in the 90s, when people thought of Image, they thought of the partner studios. Now, I think when people think of Image, they're really talking about the Image Central line, because that's become the dominant force at Image versus, you know, Spawn, Savage Dragon, and the other stuff from the other remaining partners, Top Cow, really. And I don't think it's so much a change in direction for the company so much as a change in success level, if you will.
Sure. And what we were talking about is, you know, who is the genesis of that? You know, to some extent, you can look at Robert Kirkman, right? You know, he comes along, and with the creation of Invincible and The Walking Dead and some of these things that, you know, it's you've taken a lot of time over on the Weekly Spotlight, where we were tracking for a long time, and on the Mayo Report, the sales of Walking Dead were ultimately it passed Spawn.
He is the golden boy at Image, because this is a guy who came out of pretty much nowhere. Came out with a title that for the first couple of issues, it's like, is he going to keep it around or not? It was a nothing title at the time. But then around that sixth or seventh issue, I'd have to go look back at the chart, he sticks it out long enough. He perseveres, and it turns around. It starts getting that word-of-mouth campaign, and then it starts climbing. It goes from like 6,000 to 7, then 8, then 9. And it just climbs up that chart, and it's the opposite of most trends. Most comics, you start at a certain level of sales, you drop by about 20% on the second issue, another 10 on the third, and then it just slowly erodes from there. And when he turned that around during that first year, and it was a similar curve for Invincible. Give it 6 to 10 issues, and then it picks up steam. It needed time to build an audience or to hit that turning point in the story that locks people into the title. And, you know, it's interesting because Kirkman's level of success critically and I think sales-wise on Walking Dead is phenomenal. Walking Dead is still doing somewhere around, I'm going to say, 24,000 on the monthly side, but then you look at how it's been collected in trade paperback and hardcover and expanded hardcover and the gargantuan hardcovers or whatever. It seems like every different way he prints the same story, it still sells.
Right.
And it's like, wow.
And he's astonished by it, right?
Who wouldn't
be? He's gone on record as saying, oh my God, I keep putting it out in all these different formats and people keep on buying the thing.
And it's good stuff. But it's unfortunate that I don't think he's had that golden touch on everything he's done. Because he's tried a few other things that I've enjoyed. Brit, less so with Astounding Wolfman, and a few other things. And he's having a hard time kind of capturing that lightning in a bottle multiple times. I think he kind of has with Invincible. But
I think to some extent it just it gets to that, you know, how much are people going to get? Because, you know, like Britt, I like Britt a lot. I think Britt, you know, of his, you know, after Walking Dead and Invincible, I really like Britt a lot. And it just never really took off. It never, you know, to some extent when he did the series of one-shots, he was doing those. But then he had Bruce Brown do the ongoing series because he couldn't at that time he could do that many different series because he was doing the Marvel stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if maybe at that time he wasn't doing the Marvel stuff and like then he branched off and he did Astounding Wolfman, if he had continued on with Britt at that time when it was, you know, primed, that might have been a different story.
Well, the other thing he's done that's smart is kind of have his own books in its own corner of the Marvel, Image universe. And he'll have guest stars from some of the Image stuff at times, but he's doing his own little universe building where he's got characters that cross over between the different books. And it gives it a deeper background or richer tapestry to work off of than some other independent books. And Jay Farber's done a similar thing over at Image with Noble Causes and Dynamo 5. And has the potential of the same sort of success story that Kirkman's has. But again, just hasn't totally clicked with the audience out there. And Kirkman, I think, had an unusual level of success. And, I mean, he's been rewarded for that because he's a partner at Image. He's kind of in charge of the Image Central line. And it would be nice to have seen over the last year and a half, when he's been in charge of that, to have seen him pull up people like Jay Farber or other creators and really make that Image Central line a smashing success. Right now, I think he's shown it can be a success, but not that it's got a consistent track record of, say, a Vertigo kind of a thing where, you know, they've had success after success after success. Vertigo's also had some not successes. But it just seems like once you get past partner books at Image these days, I'd be hard-pressed to name any title that's made it to, say, issue 35. Or even issue 30, for that matter. I'm sure there's been a couple, but they're rare. And then you look at, again, Walking Dead's at issue, 70 or something?
Yeah.
Same with Invincible. So Kirkman, I think, has shown that there's a viable outlet at Image and that there's an audience to be had for well-written books. But he's also shown, I think, it's you gotta hang in there for that first year or two to see that happen. So I do think the big change for Image, though, is shifting from people thinking about the partner studios to thinking about the Image Central studio and that reflection of they just do a couple of knockoff 90 type properties to they've got this amazing range of versatile properties and
right.
genres.
And that's what I think of because, I mean, frankly, most of the stuff that probably almost exclusively the stuff I buy a lot of Image stuff every month. And other than Kirkman, you know, who has become a partner recently, none of it's from any of the original Image partners. I just really don't have that much of an interest in those guys. But, you know, things like Elephant Man and Sword and Invincible and Walking Dead and, you know, lots of the other little minis that come out by these guys, I find those really intriguing and I really like them.
Yeah, same here. I used to get Savage Dragon, but dropped off that. I may get a Top Cow title or two, but really most of what I get is the Image Central stuff.
Now, another characteristic of the 2000s in the other or indie kind of scene is just the rise of so many different new companies that have been putting out some really spectacular content. And one of them that, you know, there's a couple that came and went in the 2000s. So one of those is CrossGen. And I personally, you know, whatever kind of internal strife may have happened there with their business model, and you know, some of the creators were unamused with how they were treated by the company and all that, and that, I can appreciate all that, but the fact remains that as a fan reading the stuff, there was a tremendous amount of really good comics on both the art and the writing side coming out from that company. You know, the core titles of Mystic, Meridian, Sojourn and Scion, those were tremendous books. And then, you know, we branched out and you had things like Ruse and Negation and The First and The Path and Way of the Rat and just lots of different great titles. And I like these to the point where I've got almost an entire output of that company bound in hardcover from Library Binding Company, where I can pull those things off a shelf and look at them whenever I want. They just did some fabulous comics. To me, and not something to aspire to necessarily, but they were the Valiant of the 2000s.
I was going to make that comparison too, because, well, Valiant just hit big at one point in the 90s. CrossGen kind of did that in the 2000s and really had the potential, if they had kept it together more so on the business side, to really be a major player, because, you know, when you've got people like George Perez, Mark Wade, who else did they have? They had a couple other really strong creative people over there.
Oh, Carl and Barbara Kiesel.
Yeah, well, and it's funny because you look at a lot of people that are becoming big names now. Aaron Lopresti was there as an artist doing some of their stuff for a while. Greg Land. Shoot, I'm forgetting who else. But, I mean, they had a really strong stable of who at the time were, you know, either newer to the industry or whatever, but they turned them into some really top-name talent.
Oh, Steve McNiven.
Yeah, McNiven, exactly.
And Maury Hollowell and, you know, these guys, you know, it's like they got, well, it was a boon to Marvel. You know, it's like they picked up a lot of these guys and it really helped Marvel strongly too.
Yeah, I would have liked to have seen CrossGen stick around. I loved Sojourn when they added that title after the first four. It was, yeah, it was really good, and one that, you know, I wish, because I know somebody picked up the rights to these things. I wish they would do more with a few of the titles. It was one that I was really sorry to see go away and kind of fold, and I think we would have a stronger industry now if they were still around, just because they had the diversity of material. They were on track to get stuff into movies. They were making some good decisions. Certainly it was not all, you know, rainbows and puppy dogs or what have you. There were some behind the scenes things that, you know, make me wonder if it would have been a long term viable company or not with the leadership and some of the decisions they made. But they were trying to chart new ground. They did some early stuff in getting digital distribution for comics out there, which I think kind of sort of, at least thematically, if not technically, led into the digital comics stuff over at Marvel and whatnot. So CrossGen, I think, was a trendsetter, potentially ahead of its time, and really sorry to see that go. They had some great comics. If you have not checked out CrossGen titles and you find them for cheap at a local store or at a convention or whatever, flip through them.
I find it interesting because there are lots of places that you can find them cheap, and I certainly found a parallel, you know, just from my way. You know, I don't find my only set of comics. I have found an entire parallel set of CrossGen comics that is what I got bound, and I don't think I paid more than about $1 a copy for anything, but I have seen them for still going for cover price or more other places, and can't say they're not worth it, but you can find them cheap if you look hard enough.
Yeah. Another publisher that came and went during the last decade that didn't last long enough for me was Future Comics. They came out with Metallics, Free Mind, Death Mask, and maybe one other title? Or was that it?
I think that was it. We did, didn't we do a back issue spotlight on them?
Did a back issue spotlight on them. It was Dick Giordano. It was Bob Layton. It was a couple other people who'd been around the industry for a while. They tried to make a go of it. They had some really interesting concepts that were such that they could easily gear them to cartoons and movies had they, you know, wanted to and had the opportunity to. Smartest decision they made was to try to self-distribute their books. It made them a little harder to get, but worked out reasonably well for them. Unfortunately, they finally got Diamond to say, yes, we'll distribute your books, and that more or less spelt the end of them in pretty short order, which is unfortunate, because I think they were business-wise charting some new ground and content-wise telling some really solid stories.
I think they were based out of Florida.
Yes.
And it was funny because I was down on a business thing down in Orlando, and I was at local shops and stuff down there, and boy, they just had tremendous numbers of these future comics, like really cheap and like quarter bins and stuff. I think, you know, that filtered into the local economy down there when they went under. I know, you know, I just found lots of issues and, you know, completed runs of things that I had never, you know, had complete runs of because of the spotty distribution on it, by just going to bargain bins in Florida.
Yeah, I don't think I had any problems getting them, but I guess my local store at the time was just ordering direct from the publisher.
Yeah, and that's the thing, you know, it's like if you were lucky enough that you had a store that was ordering directly from the publisher, then you could get a hold of them, and if your store wasn't, you were kind of out of luck. And, you know, you didn't know about it necessarily if you're just ordering from previews or something, you know, because I was getting my comics at the time, you know, I'd look in previews, and my store didn't get them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't remember how I first found out about them or whatnot, but, you know, it's unfortunate that Diamond has such a lock on the distribution and that it's hard for some people to get past that barrier at times. Now, one of the other publishers that I'm pretty sure originated during the last decade, but at the very least came into its own, was Boom Studios. And both Boom and the Boom Kids stuff, I mean, this is a publishing company that I think these days is one of the companies to keep a very close eye on, both in terms of the business decisions and just the creative output. Mark Waid, as editor-in-chief there, has been around the block a number of times at Marvel, DC, CrossGen, and pretty much everywhere else, and they're picking some really interesting titles to do for original material. They've got some good licensed properties, which we'll talk about a little later, and just what they're doing on the kids' line with the Muppets, the Pixar, the Disney stuff. They're actually trying to get new readers into comics, and if you're not checking out Boom stuff, you really have to. This, to me, was one of the best things to happen to the comic industry in a while was this company coming.
If you've got kids, you know, these are the thing I like about Boom Kids is they're, I mean, again, a lot of them's Disney properties, it's Pixar and stuff like that. But I mean, these are stuff that are suitable for kids. They're written for kids, but they're not dumbed down for kids, which is what I like about them. And it's not, you know, when you look at the Marvel stuff, for instance, that they try to make for kids, and it's just like it reads to some extent like a dumbed-down Spider-Man story or something, whereas, you know, you should really just tell a all-ages Spider-Man story if you want to do that, but they tend not to, you know. We've commented about this kind of thing before, and the kids stuff from Boom, especially some of it's for the younger kids, which I don't think we really got a lot of that for the littler kids from any of the other companies. But even as such, it's not something that the parent reading it to the kid would feel like it's insulting their intelligence. You know, they tell a good story and it's with iconic characters that the kids would be familiar with from movies and such. So it's a good way to get kids into comics. If you're a parent of some younger kids, you should really, really be checking out the Boom Kids stuff. It's some really nice stuff.
Yeah, and then outside of the kids line, I mean, you look at the Mark Waid titles, just, you know, Unknown, Irredeemable, Incorruptible, Potter's Field. He's doing some great work there himself. How he finds the time for that, and running the editorial stuff, and doing the work he's doing over at Marvel and DC, I don't know, but it doesn't seem to be taking any toll on the quality of his work. And then, you know, they've done licensed properties with Eureka. What other original stuff have they done over there?
Original stuff?
They did the Mr. You know, Stuffins, like, or whatever.
Northwind,
they, yeah.
They have lots of stuff that's like short series that are really quite interesting. They did that Hexed, or...
Yeah, it was Hexed.
Hexed. And, you know, they also had
the Cthulhu stuff.
Yeah, the Cthulhu stuff. They've got a strong franchise in that. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, they kind of started out, it was a lot of Cthulhu, Warhammer, and zombie stuff, which was well done, but it was kind of a niche. And then when they kind of branched out into stuff that, not in a bad way, but, you know, seemed more like it could be a movie treatment or something, like Northwind and, you know, some of the other ones that they came into. And now that they're doing the licensed properties with, like, Fox Atomic Studios and the Die Hard books and the, you know, 28 Days Later and, you know, some of these other books, I think they're doing a lot of nice things to reach out to new audiences. And this is something that hopefully will do some revitalization effort into comics as well.
And this is one where I think the diversity of their lineup is staggering. Everything from, you know, what you'd want to get for a young kid to a, you know, slightly older kid to a teenager to an adult to somebody who's really into a particular genre or whatever. You know, for a sci-fi fan, they've got the Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep. They've got Farscape stuff. They've got a very, very impressive lineup. And if there's a publisher out there right now that's going to kind of break into the next level or whatever of publishing, I mean, it's going to be hard for anyone to give Marvel or DC a run for their money, but... You know, certainly I think Boom is in that next tier down in a very solid publisher right now, along with, you know, Radical, Dynamite, and IDW, and Image and Dark Horse, of course.
I think that, you know, an interesting thing that you can go there is, like, that second tier of publishers there, they're using a lot of the licensed properties to build a strong backbone for the company. And you can look at Dark Horse even now with the Star Wars and Buffy stuff, you know, keeping a nice recognizable backbone through it. And then you got the IDW has got the Transformers and G.I. Joe, and Dynamite has got, you know, your Zorro properties and Buck Rogers and Man with No Name and Xena, Army of Darkness. What am I forgetting over there?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. They've got so many great licenses, though. What's interesting, though, is some of these, like you said, are using that to form kind of their backbone of output and financial base or whatever. But these companies are also, I think, doing a very good job of balancing that with original creator-owned material, which is where I think Devils Do had a misstep over the last 10 years, where it came kind of out of nowhere, built up a really strong base off of Transformers and G.I. Joe.
And then they lost the license.
Then you lose the license, and it's like you scramble.
Right.
So I think Boom, because it's got so many different licenses, is a little less exposed to that. And also they've got their own original material. Dynamite, again, leveraged licenses against different properties, but also has some original material with the Project Superpowers and...
The Boys.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're doing some other stuff, too. Like they're moving out even into the literary stuff, where they do like that Complete Dracula, the Alice in Wonderland stuff. You know, it's just... They're doing stuff at Dynamite that I think... they try to hit different genres and different audience segments. I think where Boom has a leg up on some of these other ones is I think Boom's marketing machine and Boom's vision, and you know how you know they got the newsstand distribution deals, and they're reaching out even into the kids market, puts them kind of a cut above a lot of the other ones. Boom has done a really nice job with that stuff.
I think you're right. Boom's got a strong marketing group with Chip Mosher and stuff. Add to that the strong editorial direction from Mark Waid, and that's a really good combination. So, you know,
one that I think, you know, stands out also different than those others is when we look at Radical that's just come out in the last couple of years. And I look at Radical as kind of following the model that Marvel started way back when they tapped into, you know, it's the vein of Filipino artists and South American and European artists that had been not really showcased by a lot of the other comic companies of the day. And Radical seems to have tapped into some of these artists from the studios in Singapore and Asia that have been turning out this fabulous art, and the production values on the books that they've been putting out is so much higher than I see from other books. That they're just visually spectacular, and there's been good stories to go with the art. And I'm really hoping that, you know, they've got a lot of movie properties in development, but, you know, a lot of things get into development and then they don't actually come to fruition. So, boy, I would love to see a Caliber movie or a Shrapnel movie or some of these other ones that they've got movie deals on. You know, actually seeing the movie of that would be great. And it's just, you know, they use it. Some people give a knock to the company of saying, oh, yeah, they're just doing movie treatments. Well, I mean, if it was just a movie treatment, I'd say sure, but they're entertaining stories, and I think they stand up as comics, regardless of whether they're also suitable to be a movie.
Well, it's
they
it's
stand
funny,
on their own.
Because I would classify a lot of the Radical stuff as a printed movie, not as a comic book movie, movie treatment done as a comic book. And to me, the difference is a movie treatment done as a comic book is you would essentially have written the movie treatment or maybe even the script, handed it to an artist, and they'd just kind of draw the comic, okay, and it'd be almost, I don't want to say a low-budget production, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Whereas with the Radical stuff, it is like you are in the movie theater at a high-budget summer blockbuster sort of a thing where they've spared no expense on the visuals and the story, and you're just happening to be reading it versus, you know, seeing it animated and moving. Because, I mean, the production values on this was something like Hotwire with Caliber, with Hercules. They've raised the bar in terms of the quality and the depth of the art, in terms of the painted nature. The production values are top notch. Again, these guys, they could take their comics, they could do it as a movie, and it would be as if the comic had come to life, because it's as if the movie had come into the comic. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's they're in a class on their own at the moment for me. And they're definitely a company worth watching, and one that I think once some of their stuff goes into movie theaters and the trades start getting noticed at the bookstores and whatnot, that's going to be the turning point for that company.
Yeah, they're one of these ones where I think some of our listeners sometimes get sick of hearing us talk about them, but, you know, try them out because, you know, John and I read a lot of comics, and if we're raving about these guys, there's got to be something going on there.
There have been a couple that were, I don't say hard sells for me, but ones that are not titles I would normally gravitate to. Hotwire is a good example of that. And, you know, I read it, I got hooked.
But not everything is going to be a hit for everybody.
No,
right?
No,
I mean,
certainly not.
I have a little, you know, they haven't really gone outside of my, because I read lots of different genres, but I mean, they've gone and they've kind of, you know, like FVZA, you know, I love that book, but, you know, that's really not something that you would enjoy. And, you know, I think there's a diversity there, but not everyone's going to like every title that they come out with. But, boy, there's got to be something there that someone would like. The one thing that they haven't done is they haven't done any superhero stuff. So if you only like superheroes, there's not going to be a whole lot coming out from Radical that is going to be appealing. But if you kind of step outside of the superhero genre, there should be something, you know, in either sci-fi, adventure, horror, crime, you know, these different genres. They have got lots of things to offer.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. I think one of the other big things that you were mentioning earlier was just the plethora of licensed titles. Boom, IDW, Dynamite, Dark Horse, all of them are doing a lot of, you know, comics based on movie and television properties. And on the one hand, that's a smart move just because it's got the recognition, they're marketable properties, you can leverage the interest in the shows, etc. But what gets me is pretty much across the board, these are really, really well done licensed properties. And it's not like, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago or whatever, where you'd get, be it a comic book series based on V, I guess it'd be more like 20 years ago, and it was just almost a by-the-numbers sort of a thing.
Really dry, you know, like when Marvel used to do those movie adaptations, those were pretty weak. I mean, they were, you know, they were not top-notch. And I think, you know, the other thing was is that they used to just take probably not the top-notch talent either on writing or art, and they would just give them those things to do kind of a translation, almost a rote translation into a comic book to just capitalize on some movie or TV show that's coming out.
And it was a very much by-the-numbers kind of a thing, right?
Yeah.
So the stuff you get these days is often quasi-considered canon, and in some case may actually be considered canon, is often done by people connected to the show or movie, if not the actual people who did the show and movie. I mean, you've got writers from Buffy doing the Buffy stuff. You've got the writers of the Star Trek movie doing both the adaptation of the Star Trek movie and the ones that tie into that.
Yeah, you got Rockne O'Bannon doing Farscape stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've got stuff that is as authentic and authoritative as it possibly can be, and in some cases is really expanding the material and the franchises within it. So it's a really great time if you're interested in the licensed properties, because there's a ton of them to choose from, and they're just in sync with the source material and a good complement to it.
I mean, I think I've said before, I think that some of these comic shops are missing a beat in not having, you know, right up at the front, like just a whole, you know, because the people who are hardcore superhero and comic fans and stuff, you know, they're going to find the superhero stuff. You know, it's like you could put the Marvel and DC stuff at the bottom of a box at the back corner of the store, and your hardcore comic book fan is going to find that stuff, right? You know, it's like right in the front of the store, put the stuff that, you know, the Simpsons and, you know, these, movie tie-ins and, you know, all this kind of stuff, Star Wars and Buffy and, I mean, you know, The Man with No Name. I mean, even some of these lower-end titles that, you know, someone's, oh, I saw, you know, it's like Fan of the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and it's like slap up a Clint Eastwood picture there, you know.
What I would have done at this point, you know, at the beginning of 2010, I would have had the Doctor Who stuff front and center and very obvious.
The relaunch of that, yeah.
They just ended the reign of the 10th Doctor, moving into the 11th. IDW's got some great stuff out there with the 10th Doctor and some of the previous Doctors. Leverage that interest, you know? It's a missed opportunity for stores. You know, I looked at the sales numbers for the Star Trek comic, Star Trek Countdown, that tied into the movie. And both on the trade and the comic side, I think it really underperformed based on how that movie did. And again, it was by the guys writing the movie and tied directly into the movie. It literally led into it and whatnot. So I think licensed titles are certainly here to stay, certainly the backbone of a number of publishers. Hopefully not to the point where they'll be crippled if they lose particular licenses. but also an area that potentially is even underperforming. So, definitely a good decade for licensed titles. Now, the other thing I found kind of interesting over the last 10 years, and a lot of this is in the last couple, 4 or 5, is the resurgence of Golden Age and public domain characters. And with the public domain ones specifically, you've got things like Project Superpowers over at Dynamite, the next issue project at Image on the rare occasion when an issue comes out, things like Terra Obscura over at the America's Best Comics at Wildstorm. Going into more of the Golden Age stuff, you've got things like the 12, the Marvel Project. There just seems to be a renewed interest in some of these older characters, which I think is great. So, you've also got collected editions of things like the Green Llama over at Dark Horse, and I'm trying to think which other publishers are doing some of those, but...
Dark Horse has been doing a wide variety of some really old, cool archives. You know, they in the all in the 2000s. We're talking about, you know, they did the Magnus Robot Fighter and Solar Man of the Atom. They've done some old Tarzan stuff. They've done Herbie the Fat Fury. They've they've done a lot. They did both Joe Kubert's Tarzan, and then they did some other Tarzan stuff as well. But they've been finding some really interesting old comics that, you know, these are the kind of things that it's both really rare to find, and they're really expensive old comics. And if you want to try these things out, you know, buying an archive is probably the lowest cost alternative to getting them, even if you could find them.
Yeah. And finding them would be a real challenge. So it's good to see kind of that interest return. And I mean, there have been other highlights over the last decade. You know, we've got things like Mouse Guard. Did we decide if Bone was the 2000s?
Bone came out like starting in the early 90s. It ran through and actually had its completion in the 2000s. So, you know, Bone as a phenomenon actually happened in the 2000s, because after it completed, I mean, then you got like just, it got picked up by Scholastic and reprinted. You had the Bone One edition, you know, where they had that whole huge
thing in one volume, yeah.
In one giant volume that, you know, I think a lot of people discovered Bone for the first time in the 2000s, even though it has been around for a lot longer than that.
What else was kind of a big smash success on the indie scene?
Oh, we had Strangers in Paradise pretty much ran its course, and that was a really nice series that came and went. Queen and Country from Greg Rucka is another one.
Cerebus 300.
Cerebus finished its lengthy 300-issue run in the 2000s. That was certainly a landmark. Mouse Guard. Hopefully we're going to be seeing a lot more of that moving forward. That's a really charming thing, and I hopefully that will, we'll see more of that as time goes on, certainly. I'm trying to think, when did Hellboy come around? This will maybe segue into one of your other topics, but you got Hellboy is certainly – come into a real popularity in the 2000s and the movies, the Hellboy movies. You know, you were talking earlier before we started recording about the kind of notch up in the quality of Hellboy movies.
Yeah, because I mean, this last category,
not Hellboy movies,
but
comics,
movies in general. Yeah. The last category I had for us to talk about was just kind of comic book related stuff. I know we're all comics all the time, but I think there have been a couple of things outside of the printed comics that had a very profound impact on the printed comics. And one of those is just the comic book movies and television shows. You know, everything from Smallville to the Spider-Man movies, the X-Men movies, the Blade movies, the Hellboy movies, you know, you name it, There's just been a huge
Watchmen.
Watchmen,
know?
Spirit,
Superman
Sin
Returns,
City, Superman.
Batman Begins.
Right. You know, just a whole ton of these things. And it's gotten to where there's a level of acceptance and acknowledgement in the mainstream media and mainstream audience of, you know, the superheroes and the comic book genre and comic book format and material. You know, we've got an unprecedented high point of, you know, comics and their properties are cool and accepted than I think we've ever had before, save maybe the Batman craze in the 60s. You know, the other thing that I think is, you know, kind of been a game changer a bit over the last 10 years, the New York Comic Con. I mean, I haven't actually been, but it went from not existing to being a major convention almost instantly. You know, they had too many people show up the first year and had to turn people away, but with the second year, they were able to handle that and not have a problem.
I think it was just you know, you have this huge amount of people and the comic industry, you know, for a large part based in New York, and there was no major con there. And, you know, just a burning need. There wasn't really, you know, you had some wizard shows and some smaller shows on the East Coast, but there was no real analog for the San Diego Comic Con on the East Coast. And let's really just be frank. I mean, It's not reasonable for people to travel easily, you know, transcontinental to go to a Comic Con.
No.
You know, so, you know, there's a number of people on the East Coast who would love to go to San Diego, but it's just not feasible. And especially now that San Diego is like selling out like a year in advance, practically, you know, it's like it's even less feasible for someone to go to San Diego. And then they make a show that's right in their backyard. You know, it's like, you know, people from Boston down to Washington, D.C. can pretty easily make it to New York City, I think, and get to that show. So,
yeah, I think that was a convention wise, the New York show was a turning point. As was the wizard stuff, shutting down the Texas one. Now they're going to have one in Austin this year, they say.
Yeah, they shut down the L.A. one, too.
And just it's been a transition period for Wizard. And having a non-Wizard, essentially its own new thing with the New York Comic Con, I think is cool. I think 2010 through 2020, you know, we're going to, the next 10 years, see a shakeout maybe on the convention side. New York continuing to grow, no doubt. San Diego being capped by physical capacity for a couple of years. And there's going to be some turning point there. I don't know what or when it'll be, but that'll be interesting. And then just, you know, kind of seeing what happens with the Wizard stuff. So, New York Comic Con, obviously comic book related. Big, I think, turning point for the industry. One of the other things that I wanted to point out, because I know it was a big turning point for me, drawer boxes. You know, this is the first new technology, if you will, for a comic book storage since I think comic book boxes were invented to begin with.
Oh, yeah, since the long box.
Since the long box, or did it come before the short box? Which came first?
I think the long box came first.
Either, but since the other was, they're the same thing. It's just the size, yeah. And this may seem like a silly thing to mention in a decade in review sort of a thing, but I can now actually get to all my comic books. You know, I could not do that before. So if you haven't checked out drawer boxes, go to collectiondrawer.com and check those out. If you've got a sizable collection, you got to get these.
Yeah, I've still got to make a big order of them to put out in my garage, but, you know, I don't want them sitting directly on the floor, so I got to kind of build a – you know, what the piece that they're missing, in my opinion, is in building some kind of a frame to set them on that would set them up off the floor.
That would be an
excellent
companion.
That will hold the weight of the six, you know, because you can stack six of them. So if they made like a metal or one of those really hardcore, sturdy composite plastic things that you could – you know, put together and make a row that would just hold them up off the floor in case you get like a, you know, like your water pipe burst and you get an inch of water or something, you know, just held them like 2 inches up off the floor, the bottom one, I would have drawer boxes today if
I think
if
that's
something like that existed.
Excellent idea for a companion product, particularly if they were such that they were the size of a drawer box and interlocked between multiple ones.
Exactly. You'd have to, it would have to exactly fit those things and allow you to, you know, kind of put them together so you could have that entire row of drawer boxes. But, you know, they have to be sturdy because they have to hold the weight of that column of drawer boxes up to six high.
Right. Man,
but that's what's stopping me right now is, you know, just having something like that that would keep them up off the ground.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. But being able to stack my comics six high and get to the bottom ones at any point has been just great. It's been amazing. The other big thing over the last 10 years for comics has been the internet. And really, there's two sides of this. There's the comic book podcasting and websites, which I think has just exploded over the last 10 years. Obviously, podcasting didn't exist back then, and now there's, seems like every time you turn around, somebody else is creating a new comic book podcast. And I think that's great. Comics are meant to be discussed and enjoyed. Podcasting's a great way to do it. That's, I think, why we do it.
It is really given a lot of people a connection and a community that, you know, it still exists in the comic shops, right? You know, I don't want to take away from that, but, you know, you used to have to, you know, get and go and hang around at the comic shop and talk, which is still fun. I still now do it, but, you know, now you have this ability with the forums and podcasts to kind of just do it anytime you want, and it's been phenomenal for me.
Yeah. No, it certainly, you know, enhanced my enjoyment of comics tremendously. Just the podcast we do and plus all the others out there to listen to. I looked at one point and there were like 100 or 2 easily.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how many are active right now, but it's got to be at least that many.
The only downside is just there's too many to physically listen to, especially some of them that just, I love them, but man, they put out so many hours of podcasts that there's not enough physical hours in the day to listen to everything that I'd want to listen to.
Yeah, you know? Same here. I don't listen to as many as I'd like to. You know, I'd love to be listening to every episode of Raging Bullet, 11 O'Clock Comics, and a couple of these others. But, man, when they're 2 or 3 hours per episode, I just... I've got a long commute, but not quite that long. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's what hurts me is I have no commute.
Life's rough, isn't it, Bob?
I know, but I don't have that, and I don't have that time in the car to listen to them, you know, and just like a lot of times that I'll be working on, you know, something like I'll be working on my previews list or working on something for the podcast. I'm playing a different podcast in the background on my iTunes, but that's pretty much when I listen because I can't listen to them while I work either because the nature of my work is more interactive where I'm usually working with other people and it's not something where I'm just sitting doing coding or doing, you know, something that would allow me. I know a lot of people have jobs that they can listen to a podcast while they're working and I can't do that.
Yeah. The other part of the internet that I think has just been a game changer for comics over the last 10 years is online comic book shopping. Both in terms of back issues and new issues. I mean, back issues, it used to be pretty much just Mile High Comics. Now there's mycomicshop.com, comiccollectorlive.com, of course, eBay, Torpedo Comics, just a slew of these things.
And really, you know, you've opened up to me, and you have the individual companies. Like, you know, you got Mile High Comics and mycomicshop.com and Torpedo Comics. Those are independent. You know, individual companies. What I like about eBay and what I like about Comic Collector Live is it has opened up almost like a flea market of like I have access to, well, more so on eBay, I find for me is better for finding those old key issues that I want at a decent price, you know, and I kind of like will try to find, you know, like those specific rarer items. I do a good job on those on eBay. But Comic Collector Live for me is, you know, that's the, you know, giving me access to, you know, 20 or 30 different storefuls of 50-cent bins, you know, across the country. And there's lots of people that'll have, you know, free shipping if you spend, you know, $25 or $30 or something, you know. So it's just like you look around and just like, you know, I get like, you know, 50 comics for $30 or something, you know. It's really amazing what you can do there with some places.
Yeah, it's certainly a highly effective way to be emptying your bank account while sitting at your computer.
Yeah.
And then the other game changer for me in terms of comic book buying is getting my new comics through DCBSService.com. You know, discount comic book service I've been using for about 5 years now, a little over, I guess. Get my weekly comics. It's awesome. I save a ton of money. It's convenient. I don't miss things. Certainly, you know, I go hit Tribe Comics and stuff periodically to go pick a few things up, a Talk Shop, whatever. You know, I don't think the need for physical stores is any less than it was before, but certainly it's so nice for me just to be able to pop into the UPS store, spend 2 minutes, get my package, walk out the door, and I'm done. You know, it's really convenient, and it's saving me a ton of money. So I think that's a major shift in the industry from 10 years ago.
And I've been getting them from them for 4 years now. Doesn't seem like it, but I started I think my first order was like maybe around November or so of 2005. But, you know, certainly all year of 2006, 7, 8, and 9, I was getting my books from them. So just phenomenal way of getting books at a decent price is handy for when you get as many as we do.
And there are other online stores out there. Certainly stay with your local shop if they're treating you well and you're happy with them. But if you don't have a local shop, I certainly recommend DCBS, but shop around, find what you're comfortable with.
Other people have used other ones, you know, and, you know, there's lots of ones, and if they're giving you good service, that's all you're looking for. But, you know, I hear from a lot of people, it's just they don't have a good shop reasonably close to them. And I know one of the things that was a big swing for me was just the cost of gas, you know. It's like a lot of people, I think one of our listeners also is like, you know, it's like a 40-mile drive or something for him to get to a comic shop. And it's just like, that's not reasonable, you know, doing an 80-mile round trip. You know, you can do that every now and again just for fun as
but
a
who has
field
time
trip.
To do
but,
that
you
every
know,
week, yeah.
Yeah, you know.
It's
That's why I think even the weekly shipping, you know, option, you know, you spend like $20 a month. That's only like $5 a week on the weekly shipping. And, you know, I was spending more than that on gas driving up to the comic shop once a week,
mm-hmm.
you know, as far as I was going.
Yeah, yeah.
I think at the height of the gas crisis, I was looking at like I was spending about $12 for a round trip, you know, up and back to the comic store in gas.
Well, for me, the expense wasn't so much the gas, which I never bothered to compute, although I'm sure that was a couple of pennies or dollars or whatever, or even the time, so much as the impulse buying. It's like, ooh, that looks cool. I'll pick that up too. And I would just – I'm an easy sell for comics, so the lack of temptation by not going into the shop every week is certainly, you know, helped me keep my spending a little more under control.
Oh, I still do that. I still like doing that. I probably spend.
Well, I still do it, and I still like doing it. I just try not to do it as often.
I mean, I go up to the Comic Tunes and Toys almost weekly, and I probably drop somewhere between $100 and $150 a month in there.
Yeah.
Just getting, like, other stuff, back issues or just indie books that I hadn't, you know, picked up or, you know, I could almost always count on being able to find pretty much whatever I missed in there. You know, if we need to do something for the show, I can go there and I know I can find usually what we need.
Mm-hmm. mean, all in all, it's been a very interesting decade for comics. Certainly, I think the landscape now is, in some cases, very similar, but in other cases, so different than where it was 10 years ago. And no doubt that's going to be the case 10 years from now. You know, be it that trades have taken over or online stores have taken over, or who knows what may or may not happen over the next 10 years, you know, or what publishers are kind of the major ones and which are long since forgotten. But it's certainly going to be an interesting 10 years. Anything else? Or does it pretty much do it?
Yeah. So will we be here for the decade in review number 2?
I don't know, but I am numbering this episode just for the heck of it.
Number 1.
But I encourage the listeners to go to our forum. Let us know what you thought the highlights were of the last 10 years. I'm sure a lot of that I'll read and say, oh, crap, I should have remembered that. That is true, you know, kind of thing. My memory sucks. I have a hard time with these 10-year or, you know, any kind of retrospective episode. But definitely go to our forum. Let us know what you think that we got right, we got wrong, what we forgot about, whatever.
And by the way, if you go to our forum and sign up for the forum, it needs to be approved by John or myself, and I try to do that, but we get a lot of spam bots trying to sell people, you know, sell you Viagra or Swampland in Florida or whatnot, that I think just prowl around the internet and create accounts on various forums so that they can spam them. So that's why we have it turned on where you need administrator approval. And sometimes it'll slip through the cracks. So if you sign up to be on the forum and you don't get your account activated like by the next day, just shoot an email to the guys at comicbookpage.com and say, hey, you know, I signed up and, you know, my account hasn't been activated yet, and we'll make sure we go in, and that'll distinguish you from the spam bots, because I try to look at them, and there's certain patterns that I can tell if it's a real person or if it's one of these bots. But if for some reason you have any problem, just shoot us a note, and we'll get you taken care of right away.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're trying to keep the thing free of spammers and stuff.
Yeah, so. I don't want to log on and see all kinds of ads all over, you know, so we take those down if they show up, but you know what I mean.
It's funny because those seem to come in waves. We'll go for a while where we get none of it, and then suddenly we get a ton, and that's where we're at the moment. But yeah. But we encourage discussion on this. Certainly want to know what you guys think was the highlights of the last 10 years and what you're looking forward for the next 10. Cool. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.